listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY
Musician.
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 188 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
Great. It was good to see you in the flesh last week in Nashville.
Yes, we had an amazing time in Nashville at the Music Biz Conference. You and I did a session together about authentic artist branding that went very well. That was fun.
Once we figured out how to use PowerPoint.
Yeah, it took us a little while, only halfway through the session. Hey, I'm a guitar player. I'm not here to run a computer.
Yeah.
People who have been listening to this podcast a long time know that we could be technically challenged at times.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. I had not been to Nashville in, I think, like 15 years. And the last time I was there was maybe for an afternoon or two. And it felt like a small, quaint, cozy little touristy town for country music fans. And like, it felt like Vegas to me this time around.
It does have some of that feel to it. It's very much like Party Central. There's one thing I'm not, Chris, is a liar. When I say that the DIY Musician Conference, the 2017 edition of that conference in Nashville is in Party Central, I'm not making that up, was I?
No, and I didn't think you were exaggerating. I just thought you were so excited about all the music history stuff that's sort of what you were referring to about the excitement in the party. But no, there's like literally a party going on everywhere. There's there's these, what do they call them? Booze caravans or something? Like
they call them beer bikes or
beer
something.
Bikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like every 2 minutes you see going down the street, like this little pedal powered, bar.
Pedal pub. I think that's what
pedal
they call
pub. Yeah. With a whole bunch of people.
Every 2 minutes, that's a slow time.
and this is, I'm not talking about like 8 p.m. This is 10 a.m. Like people are, they got their drink on early. But it wasn't just the party atmosphere. It was, there were lots of new skyscrapers, big buildings. Everything just felt bigger. And I loved it. I totally fell in love with the city. I was a music tourist as well. I went to the Ryman and Third Man Records and all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah, and all this stuff is walking distance from the hotel where our conference is at. It's going to be an experience. I highly recommend you be in Nashville August 25th through 27th when we do the DIY Musician Conference. It's only $99 right now, and that price is not going to last. You can go to DIYMusicianCon.com to get tickets. And we were there we were at the Music Biz Conference, but we were also there planning and doing some final preparations for our conference. And yeah, it's going to be a good time. It's Party Central. It's Music History Central. It's all walking distance from the hotel. And even if you don't like country music, it's still something that as an artist I find very fascinating and intriguing because it's so prevalent in that city. There's more than country music there, but I mean, the historical aspect of it is very much country-centric. But even if if that's not your thing, to me, it's so in your face. It's just, how can you not appreciate it?
And you will at least once hear, as Kevin promised me, Don't Stop Believing. At least once. Performed by a live band, I should say.
I was true to my words. I told you. Chris, you will hear Don't Stop Believing at one of these venues we go to. And on the last night you were there, we walked in. Right as we walked in, the front person said, "Do you want to hear some Journey?" And I'm like, "It's coming. I knew it."
Yeah, you didn't lie about that either. That was a cool street. What's that called? Broadway, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, you walk down this street and there's probably 20 different music venues. And the sound is kind of like 6th Street in Austin. The sort of the sound is bleeding into out into the atmosphere as you're walking down the street, and you can kind of be drawn in whatever direction. Are you feeling like a honky tonk? Are you feeling like modern country? Do you want like pop covers? You just sort of follow your ear.
There was even hip-hop karaoke.
Oh, I didn't hear that, but that's cool.
I'm not sure we walked by the night we were out. Yeah, we did. We walked by and we lost Phil for a minute because Phil from CD Baby is a big hip-hop guy, and he was standing in the window watching as the words went by and the guys were rapping on stage. So there's everything down there, and every night we've got a venue rented for the conference where we've got our open mic at BB King's. We've got the second night we're going to do a showcase at the Cannery Ballroom, which is away from the downtown area but still walking distance, and it's one of the more premier venues in Nashville. And then the last night we're going to be back on Broadway, two floors at the Tin Roof. It's going to be so much fun. Can't wait.
It'll be so much fun that attendees should pace themselves because you really have to. Right. You're supposed to get up for a 9 a.m. session the next morning, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So
it's real easy to go, oh my gosh, it's 3:30 a.m. How did that happen? And then really feel it the next day. So yes, but it's going to be a good time. I hope to see everybody there. We also met some great folks who listened to this podcast while we were there and got to check out a recording studio and just some good people there. Really excited about our long-term plan with that city, and we're already booked for the 2018 conference and all that. So we'll be in Nashville a bunch, and that makes me happy.
Sweet.
All right. Well, speaking of conferences and stuff like that, you and I go to some conferences for CD Baby. You manage our blog. We have this podcast. We have our big call center here at CD Baby helping artists all day long. And probably one of the top questions we get asked is, why am I not making any money? Would you say that's a correct statement?
Yeah, I would. especially in terms of, hey, my music is now available on iTunes and Amazon. Why aren't I like selling thousands of copies? Like, well, yeah. Have you done anything to promote it?
Yeah. No. So what individually, it's really tough to answer that question because I get asked that at conferences all the time. Yeah, I put my music out. I'm not making any money. Why? I'm like, well, I mean, that, how long do we have here to kind of go through everything? And so
maybe it's important to ask yourself, is it because I suck?
Chris.
Is my music terrible?
You're living up to the reputation that the folks we met in Nashville, they were, what did Ted call you? Ted's probably listening to this. What did he call you?
I think he said I was the asshole of the pair.
I referred to it as good cop, bad cop or something like that.
I'm the cynic.
There you go.
The curmudgeon, yeah.
There you go. So you're just playing your role here.
Meeting expectations.
I was thinking a lot about it, and I'm thinking, you know, there is a lot of reasons why someone could not be making money, and there's some ones that are pretty obvious that are mistakes people make, and there's some that aren't as obvious. I put together a giant list of why you're not making money, and we're going to talk about that today. I sectioned everything out into five different sections, things that were relatable topics or under an umbrella topic. So, for example, topic one is shows, and so we've got a bunch of things under that. Topic two is distribution and so forth, and we'll get to all of them. So we're just going to bounce through them. It's a long list. We have some calls at the end of the show, some listener calls and feedback that we want to get to, but this list is long. So grouping number one, why you're not making money and how we related it back to your shows. And if you don't play shows, hang in there. There's plenty of good stuff coming.
And that actually could be the first mistake there. You're not playing them. You need to book some shows.
True. But there are a lot of artists these days that make music that isn't necessarily show or touring appropriate.
Yeah,
or
and touring can actually be a money suck at some point, so...
Yeah.
All right, so forget that one.
No, that was fine. That was fine. You're still on the show. But number one, how it relates to shows. Why you're not making money. So lead us off, and then we'll just bounce back and forth.
All right, so you are selling the wrong merch. You're a metal band and you have pink t-shirts, or you're a country band and all your... you know, you're not selling trucker hats or something. And you got to tailor your merch to your actual existing audience.
Yeah, this happens a lot. And if you've been in a band or been an artist for a long time that's toured and had merch, you've probably had that one merch item that you can't even give away. That's probably the perfect example of that was not the right merch item. But there are tools that you can use to help make better choices. If you distribute your music through CD Baby, there is our trending reports that will give you data about the people that are buying and listening to your music. So if your average listener is a 30-year-old female, you might not want to buy t-shirts that appeal to an 18-year-old male. So those kind of things can help you narrow that down, but it happens a lot where people buy merch that just isn't appropriate for their audience. All right.
So yeah, a logical lead off to that is no merch at all, which I think is a super common mistake for bands that maybe haven't recorded a proper EP or album yet.
And actually, this is what Small Town Poets way back in the day when we were transitioning from doing shows under the previous iteration of that band and different name to working on a Small Town Poets album, we had no merch. We were just living off the guarantees of our shows, and we probably should have gone and gotten just a cheap one-color t-shirt, something that we could sell to help pay the bills, because people would go back wanting to buy stuff when we had nothing for them.
Yeah, and then, you know, you get stickers, pins. There's a lot of low-cost options.
And speaking of things I've been guilty of, the next one, didn't put merch out. And this sounds really stupid and like, duh, but every band I've been in, every situation where there's been merch, there's been a show or many shows where someone's like, let's just not put the merch out.
Yeah, I'm still occasionally guilty of this. And I think it comes from a sort of shame. Like, you walk into the venue and maybe there's only two or three people there and you're setting up and you're like, it feels ostentatious or something to like get out your merch booth and turn the lights on and all this stuff. And suddenly you have this big merch display when there might not be enough people in the audience to justify it. But then you get on stage and you're playing a show and maybe those people want to buy something, or maybe more people come into the venue and you've not set it up. You're going to have zero sales at that point. So really it should be the very first thing you do when you walk into a venue.
Yeah, and I get the idea of feeling stupid and feeling ridiculous, like, you know, our merch booth, everyone at this show could fit inside it right now. We could do the show inside our merch booth. But, you know, you can custom tailor it, but you got to put your stuff out. You can't be complaining about not making money than making that choice night after night. And it happens a lot. Like I said, every band I've been a part of, that has happened at least once, but probably a whole lot more times at certain shows. And you just got to do it. You got to put it out there. You got to offer it to folks, because it doesn't matter if there's 100, 1,000, or 5 people in the audience. If you want to sell stuff, you got to make it available.
Right.
Even if you feel silly doing it, even if you feel like it's being super pretentious because you got this, all this stuff, you got to keep the show on the road. You got to sell stuff.
Yeah, and I think if you're playing a smaller venue or the type of place where tips are, you know, are reasonable to expect, then you should also make a habit of putting your tip jar out first thing in a and you know, seed it with a little bit of money, so you're giving people the hint that they should put some into.
All right, this next one is my number one live show pet peeve. And it's when people are standing in front of the merch table who are there just talking to the people behind the table. They're not fans that are buying stuff. They're your friends. They're your family that are talking to whoever's sitting behind the table, blocking the merch from anyone being able to go and see that it's there and buy it. Drives me crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, you say it's friends and family, but I've had this happen where it's not. It's a stranger that comes up who's yakking, maybe even about your music. And it's, you know, it could be the kind of thing you want to hear. It's praise or whatever, but they have no intention of buying anything. They're just complimenting you, and they're not taking the hint that there's 5 people behind that person that want to buy something. So then suddenly you're in this awkward position of having to be like, this is great, I'm glad you love the show, but please just give me 10 minutes and go stand in the corner while I conduct business. But it's weird to tell someone that sort of thing when...
Well, that's a perfectly acceptable thing to say. You know, I've been in that situation where it's like friends or family, especially friends, because when you're traveling around, sometimes you're in a city like, oh, there's a bunch of people that I know in this town or some regulars that come out to the show and they already have everything and they come and stand and they want to talk to you. It's perfectly acceptable to say, I would love to catch up with you guys. Can you just give me 30 minutes and then I'll be and let me sell to these folks and then I'll be able to hang out. I think the one that's the pet peeve mostly for me is when it's out of your control and it's like the person that is manning the merch table, it's either their friends or, you know, friends or whoever, but they're bored and they're like, oh, someone to talk to. So they're just not realizing that that activity just blocks out all your sales. And they'll think, well, no one else is coming up. That's because they're not going to there, or they might come up and feel ignored and just move on. Ideally, you have a merch person that's highly engaged, especially when the show's over. They're making eye contact with people. They're starting conversations, you know, chatting people up. And that's going to help you sell more merch. But having people standing in front of your table that aren't buying just kills it.
Yeah, and incentivizing the merch person either by paying them or giving them a percentage of sales or giving them free merch or just something to show that, like, you're appreciative, but also they really should be there to kind of hustle for you is, you know, a good idea if you can arrange it.
All right, you've got the next one because I know you've done some work in this area.
I've done some work in placing my merch in really bad places.
No, you've written blog posts about placing it in the right places, and you did a whole article about that.
That's true. Yeah. So poor merch placement. You know, like no one can see your merch. It's in the strange corner of the room that's poorly lit. That's a way to kill sales right there. I mean, people have to know it's there. They have to know it's available. It should be eye catching in some way, so they really can't stop looking at it. And I think this happens a lot when bands come into a room and they don't know where to put the merch. So they kind of just look for an outlet and a table and they set it up real quick without really surveying the place and saying, well, where's, you know, what's going to make sense for foot traffic? What's going to make sense for, well, for instance, the Doug Fir in, Portland has a terrible merch booth placement. And unfortunately it's kind of their permanent place, but it's right next to the bathroom. So the lines for the bathroom are always blocking the lines for merch.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite places in Portland to play, but I started to resent playing there because you would never sell any merch because they built this merch booth into the wall, like you said, directly next to the door to the bathrooms, which when there's a busy show, the line backs up in front of the merch booth and there's a railing so nobody can get to the booth without like climbing through the bathroom line. And it's also beyond where the stairs are to get up out of the venue. So if you are just going to show and want to leave, you can very easily not see the merch booth and just walk on out. And if you do see the merch booth, it can be a big hassle to try and buy something. And at that venue, they refuse to let you put your merch anywhere else. I've tried, and they're like, we spent all this money building this merch booth, and no one wants to put their merch there. And I said, because it's in the worst possible spot you could have picked in the venue. Right. It doesn't help me.
I do have friends that have made a habit of bringing their own table, which is a certain height, so it basically puts their display at eye level. And they also have like battery powered everything, so they're not reliant on outlets. And that way they can walk into a place and put it wherever it makes the most sense. They're ready to go. I mean, if you're trying to travel light, that's not always an option, but it might be worth considering.
But you did mention the idea that a lot of times artists walk in, they see, oh, there's a table, and maybe the guy at the bar or the sound guy says, oh yeah, those tables are for merch. And you just assume that the merch has to be there. So you set up and place it there, where not realizing that some dude just threw that there because they were told there needed to be a merch table somewhere. Just because it's in a certain spot doesn't mean it needs to stay there. It is a good idea to consult the venue because it might be something where they have some, you know, specific things in mind or where they always do things that you might have to talk through and really push them in the right direction. But just don't walk into a venue and go, hey, the merch table's in a back hall by the bathrooms. That's good. I guess that's where it goes. No, think strategically. Where are the people going to be? Look at the way where people have to walk out of the venue. There might be some very specific foot traffic paths that people take. Get right in the middle of that, and you'll sell more merch.
Yeah, and we mentioned bad lighting, but I think another, you know, it's not just important to have good lighting so that people see the merch, but so that they can fill out their name legibly on your email list. Like, if you're tucked away in the dark corner of something and someone scribbled their name and email on your list, like, can't really blame them.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. The next one is wrong pricing. And this one could be costing you money and be contributing to why you're not making money. If you're just assuming that your CD should be a certain price at every show. This was a debate that still pops up occasionally with me and some of the guys in Small Town Poets. We were playing, we did this residency at a church. And I said, the CD should be $15. And one of the other guys was like, man, people will pay $15 for a CD. It feels like it should be $10. I'm like, we should price them at $15. We will sell the exact amount. And the only difference is we will have made less money at $10. And we ended up selling, it was like over the course of 3 days, about 150 CDs. And that would have been a huge loss if we had only charged $10 as opposed to $15. And so I think you can easily make assumptions about pricing and make the wrong and lose money. So if you, I think it's one of those things though, on that same tour, a couple days later, we had a show in a town that was economically depressed. We knew there was going to be a lot more younger folks there. And we thought, hey, let's lower it down to $10 for this audience. That makes more sense. And it did. So it's one of those things that, you know, understanding who your audience is and adjusting accordingly. If you're playing in a very wealthy part of town, you know, charge a few more dollars because it's not going to make a difference for the sale for them. If you're playing in a part of town or a city that's more economically challenged or you're playing to college students, price it accordingly because the price is going to make a difference to them. So that's one of those things that you need to think about and don't just get stuck in a, it has to be this price. I know artists that are selling CDs for $20 and no one bats an eye. And that's you know, basically doubling their money as opposed to the artist that assumes it just has to be $10.
Well, and I think instead of just kind of willy-nilly changing the price based on the audience, you can basically set it at a higher price and then run a discount for the, you know, say it's 15 or 20, and then when you play in those towns, just say it's for sale that night.
Yeah. And when you play a lot of shows, you start to get a sense for, there's a lot of indicators, if you're paying attention, that you'll see that kind of help you gauge what it should be. So the next one, kind of pricing leads into, is not having bundles available for people to buy. Bundles are a great way to get people to buy more than they intended because they're going to save like $5. So that's like, hey, the CD is $15, the shirt's $25, but if you buy both of them together, it's $35 or $30. And it's an easy way to get people to pay more, and they get more, and you're making more per attendee than just them going, ah, never mind. They think they're getting a deal, they're going to be more motivated.
Yeah, I know a lot of times when I've played to kind of old, you know, audiences that are like early 40s and above, they like my bundle, which is any, you know, it's $10 per CD, but any three for 25. And like, I can see like groups of people kind of pairing off and they get a bundle and then they kind of divvy up the CDs. And I know they're going to go home and like, you know, maybe not even so much anymore because everyone just has Spotify, but you know, they're sort of trading it around, but I don't care. Like, I'd rather they go home with the whole set.
Exactly. Speaking of not selling CDs is another one.
Yeah. I think a lot of people make the really poor assumption that we're in a digital, entirely in a digital world. When you're playing a live show, that CD is often like the, the marker of the experience. It's the artifact that someone can take home. Whether they listen to it or not, it's like their way of connecting with the artist and showing support.
It's gone from being a carrier of media to being a piece of memorabilia. It feels like the official release of the music. So it's like, yeah, I could get a download, I can stream it, but this feels like the official release of music. I don't know how much longer that'll remain, but I still see it when people go to the merch table. They start looking for, you know, the CD just feels like the item that they know that they've been programmed is back there to buy. So if you don't have CDs, depending on your audience, you know, audiences vary these days. If your audience is 18-year-olds, you might have to have a display to tell them what a CD is. But if you, you know, depending on your audience, that can vary. But it's something that you shouldn't just go, hey, it's a streaming world now, I'm not going to get CDs anymore, because that might be costing you money at the merch table. And you can get smaller runs of disc duplication or CD manufacturing that allows you to test it out without having to spend a ton of money.
It would be interesting to pull like a bunch of younger like EDM artists and see what their sort of number one merch, that kind of connector. Because I feel like with EDM, it's probably not the CD, but for a lot of other genres, it is still. Anyways, yeah. That's a diversion, but I'll ask around.
That's a good point. You know, if at any point something that we say hits you like, oh, I want to weigh in, feel free to call our listener line or email us. We'll have all that information at the end of the show. It's also on our website, but we want to hear what's working and what's not working for folks.
So let's see. Next on the list, unorganized merch. Your t-shirts are not properly rolled up, so you're having to, you know, fish around in a plastic bag to find the women's large shirt or whatever, or you've got CDs just strewn in a box and it just looks crappy. I mean, that's not going to inspire anyone to come over and buy something.
Well, and the classic example that's happened to me multiple times that Martin Adkins always brings up is someone comes up to the merch table. They're like, oh, I'd like a women's medium. And you're like, oh, I know we have more of those, but and you're digging around in the box, you're trying to find it, you can't find it. And then you're like, sorry. They take off, and then someone else goes, oh, I need a men's extra large. And you're like, oh, digging around for that, and you find that women's medium. And then you still can't find the extra large. and then it just becomes a bunch of wasted effort and lost revenue, and artists do it all the time. You need to find a way to keep your merch organized so it's easy for you to sell. You shouldn't be organizing after the show when people are trying to buy. That's just lost money every time you're doing that. Get organized.
So the next one, we could quote Tom Jackson on this and say that you're not creating enough moments in your show that make anyone want to buy anything. So basically your show is boring.
Yeah. If you're think you're doing all these things right, everything at this point, like I've got the right merch, I think. I've been putting it out. I've got merch people ready to go, and we're just not selling as much as I feel like we should for the amount of people that are in attendance. Then it's probably time to visit what's happening on stage, how you're directing folks to what you have available, and, you know, look at that and all the missed opportunities you're leaving at that portion of it. Because if you're boring on stage, if you're not letting people know you have merch, if you're not inspiring them to go back and grab something to help keep you on the road, then you might have some problems there.
Well, and you said you're not properly directing fans. I think that's an important piece too. Like the other night I played a show with Carolyn Cotter, who is this folk artist who's been traveling around the US and Europe for about 2 years. She's constantly on the road. And at some point in her set, she had the most brilliant, confident, yet casual and like way of directing people to the merch. And basically, you know, it was saying like, if you like this isn't what she said, but the message was, if you like this, you need to go buy something because this is how I do it. By the way, the other people that are playing this show have merch too, like go and help them. it wasn't that bossy. It was really natural. But I was like, oh, that's someone who's practiced this. Like they're totally comfortable with that. And I feel like most artists aren't comfortable with like the ask. So yeah, maybe write it on your set list and say, okay, after the third song, I'm going to plug the merch. After the eighth song, I'm going to plug the merch. And just make sure you do it.
Yeah. And it needs to be creative and well thought out. It doesn't need to sound like a commercial. It can sound like a part of your story. You can weave it into your set in a way where it feels like inspiring and interesting and helpful, and not, I've been in multiple bands where this was a, like every third song, we have CDs in the back, shirts.
I know which particular band you're talking about more than others.
And like that, I just felt really awkward. I don't want to go back to that table. Something awkward might happen back there. but then it's like, here we're going to play some more songs. We'll be at the CDs. And you're like, this is horrible.
These guys are not excited about their merch. Why should I be?
Yeah, whatever's back there must suck real bad because he's totally embarrassed to be speaking about it. It can't be that way. You don't want to come off as a salesman either. But I like the idea of like reaching into what someone's experiencing and going, hey, if you're enjoying this, guess what? Time to pony up.
Yeah.
That's what they do in Nashville. They walk around with that tip jar and they give you puppy dog eyes and make you feel guilty for not throwing money in there.
Well, can I tell my story for 30 seconds?
Yes, you can.
We're going to have a slight diversion from the topic here. So when I was in Nashville...
Chris is still bitter, I should say. He was offended several times in Nashville.
I was very offended. So Kevin and I and some other CD Baby folks are at this bar. We're watching a band that was very good, a great cover band. I heard the next night they played some original stuff that was really good. Anyways, at some point, the singer... She gets off stage. She says the thing, you know, if you like what you're hearing and I'm going to go around with a bucket, please tip us. If you want us to play a specific song, it's, you know, $20, we'll move it to the front of the line. So I reached into my pocket and I got my 20 bucks out. And she came up to me and I said, can you guys play Katy Perry's Teenage Dream? And she said, we play music. And my 20 bucks went right back in my pocket.
Ooh. Hey, we should add that to this one in this first section under shows. Don't offend your audience.
I'm like, come on, you just played like 2 hours of other pop covers, like that one. Somehow that's like beneath you.
They were just like embarrassed because they didn't know it.
Yeah, well, I would have sang it for them.
Isn't it like two chords?
It's only two chords, yeah. If this band is listening, I think it's D major 7 and E sus 4.
If they are listening, I'd really like to know the guitar player's name because I tried to find him online and I don't think I had the right name. Back to our regular scheduled program. The last thing under shows, the section that we had of why you're not making money and some ideas around shows is not negotiating with the venue. And this is a mistake a lot of folks make. You're not going to be able to do it at your first gig at a venue, but if you have a good show there and have some leverage... See what you can do. It might only be worth another 50 bucks. It might be worth a couple hundred. I know that one venue here in Portland that we mentioned, the Doug Fir, for independent artists and national acts, it was a sought-after venue. It held about, I think, 400, holds about 400 people max capacity, something around there. And great sound. And so it's a sought-after venue. And so they kind of play it like they have the upper hand, like people want to play here. We don't need you. But if you can... pack it out. The next time you go, that, hey, we only got 150 bucks for you, can turn into $300 or $400 or $500. I've seen it happen with other artists, and it's just a matter of asking and saying, look, we fill this place, or do something with us. Give us that 150 and then a split of the tickets. Let's talk about how we can make this more lucrative for us because we're doing a lot of work to get people into your venue who are going to buy stuff. So that's something that you should keep in mind. Don't just take the face value offer when you have leverage. Now, don't go in guns blazing when you've never played a venue before, have no proven track record with them, and make all these demands. They're just not going to want you to be there. You're just too much work.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of bands make the mistake of not even bringing up money. They don't want to seem schmarmy in some way. So, you know, you book the gig, you get as far as booking the gig without ever discussing what the payment's going to be. And that's sort of mistake number one. Then once you know, then you can negotiate from there.
It is a challenge because you're trying to get this gig at a sought-after venue, and you know playing there will look good on your resume to get other gigs. And so you feel like, man, if I bring up money, they're just going to say, never mind. That's not necessarily the case. But you're right. You should bring that up. And there's ways to ask without it sounding like all you care about is getting paid. You want to, you know, understand the position they're in, what they're trying to accomplish at the venue, and make sure you're helping to meet their needs. So don't be afraid to talk about money and negotiate with the venue.
And we've arrived at section number two.
Yes, section number two is an interesting one. It's distribution, and that seems weird that people would screw things up when that would cause them to not make money in the distribution process, but oh, believe me, it happens.
Well, the first thing to discuss is it's important to distribute your music because we hear from artists a lot that are like, oh, I put my song up on SoundCloud. It's available. Or I put it on Bandcamp. It's available. Both those platforms are great, but that's not distribution. It's not making your music available in this kind of wide net where you're reaching fans where they like to access music.
Yeah, that is a good point because I do talk to artists all the time where they come up to me and they say, man, you just can't make money in music anymore. I'm not making any money. I'm like, okay, so, you know, like I said, it's hard to just do a two-minute assessment of someone's situation, but I'll ask some basic questions. They're like, is your music available everywhere? No, it's just on Bandcamp because it's just going to get stolen or people's just going to rip me off everywhere else. So there's no money. I'm like, well, that's a problem because if you, as an independent artist, want to make money from your music, you need to have it distributed as widely as possible because you, you know, I've used this example before. I've been at a venue before, seen a band going, oh, I like these guys. They say their name from stage, which I should have added that to the show thing because that's another pet peeve when bands never say who they are.
Oh, yeah.
They say their name from stage. I open up Spotify, look for them, can't find them. I move on. And because I'm going
to
use Spotify.
You're not going to go through the trouble of going to Bandcamp or some other where you need to create a new account and get out your credit card again. Like,
yeah,
you want people to be where you are already listening.
Now, if you're a mega pop star, things are a little different, but we're not. So you need to have your music distributed everywhere. If you need to distribute your music, just head over to cdbaby.com. It's super easy and there's no excuse. It's accessible. But yeah, starting there. So distribution. You would think that would cover it all. But we're just getting started on the distribution section. So lead us, Chris. Lead us into
okay, it. Okay, so, well, this is your item. So it says not fully monetized. I'm confused as to what you mean.
Not fully monetized meaning that the scenario happens all the time. An artist expects their album to be done. Let's say we're in May right now. Say I'm expecting it to be done at the end of May. So I plan an album release show at the end of August. Well, the last week of August is approaching. I'm still finishing my album, and that album release show is that Friday. So they come to us frantic, trying to get their album up for sale so it's available the next day, which we can do. But usually what happens is they skip a lot of things in the process. They just do all the shortcuts, don't go through the whole process of signing up and properly distributing their music. So they don't monetize stuff on YouTube. They don't get publishing administration. They don't do all the other things that can help capture all the money. And then they remember when it's too late and some of that money's lost.
I got you now. So it's basically not taking advantage of all the revenue opportunities and preparing to do that up front so that when you actually do have success, it's not revenue that you've lost.
Gotcha. if you're trying to distribute your music in a frantic panic about how it needs to be up tomorrow, you're probably going to miss out on something because you're probably taking shortcuts that don't seem to have much impact in the short term of your goal of getting your music live tomorrow. But 6 months goes by, a year goes by, and you realize you haven't been collecting. So yeah, the next couple things I have is no publishing administration, not monetizing YouTube. Those things, not selecting them, can have some negative impact on your revenue, and it's not something that you really feel until much later. And then a lot of times when you start thinking, oh my gosh, I missed that.
Right. When I think that's select- that can be a big issue with publishing administration, because I think a lot of people say, well, my music's not on the radio. It's not going to be a huge radio hit. So it's not like I'll have a ton of performance royalties. I'm not selling a bunch of international, you know, whatever. They think their stature is beneath where that would be valuable to them. But in a streaming world where every single stream is generating a mechanical royalty, you know, it can add up over the course of a lifetime of a song. Or, like, if the stars align and you do have a hit, like, you want to be set up to collect that from the get-go rather than missing the huge spike and then
yep.
catching the trail off.
It's always easier to be prepared than trying to do cleanup work. So the next one is kind of an interesting one. It also speaks to the I'm in a rush or I don't want to be bothered. I just want to get this done. Entering bad metadata. The information you enter in about your music has become more important than ever, especially in a digital world. And if you follow what's happening in, you know, the digital music world, you'll see lots of articles about metadata. And it's just the idea of trying to better account for the musical files that are being pushed around on the internet so we can track people properly. And if you're not entering in your name the way it should be, if you're just taking shortcuts there, it can cause all these problems that make it harder for people to identify if that music is yours or someone else's. And so you need to take the time to put things in properly.
Yeah, and that serves the two purposes of A, searchability, so someone can find music that suits their needs, and then B, once they have and it's being listened to, accounting for who should be paid for that.
Correct. And speaking of who should be paid, this is a common problem, is that a lot of people haven't registered their songs with a PRO.
Guilty.
I was guilty for years too.
On my last album, I didn't submit, you know, I thought, oh, I'm affiliated with ASCAP, I'm good. As if ASCAP is just psychically aware that I've put out new music that they should now be collecting for. And then I thought, oh, what an idiot. I need to go and tell them. What a novel idea. Hey, yeah. Guys, I have 10 new songs.
And through our publishing administration service, we will do that work for you. But it happens a lot with artists with, you know, back catalog, or just as they release new music, if they don't use our publishing administration service, you have to go tell the PROs that you, whoever it is, whoever you have, because you may not be, I know we have a lot of listeners outside the US, it might be different, the process, wherever you're at, but you need to let them know that these songs exist. Sometimes they can connect the dots years down the road, if there's a revenue stream that and somehow things align where they figure out who you are, but you don't want to leave that guesswork to them. You just want to go and enter that information. It doesn't take long, and that way they have it, so they know to attribute those to you. And speaking of registering, we have here in the US Sound Exchange, and if you haven't registered with Sound Exchange, you're probably losing out on some money.
Yeah, so just real briefly, the previous topic of registering with a performing rights organization covers you for some portion of publishing royalties related to the song. Sound Exchange is going to cover you for the actual sound recording of that song. So labels and artists should sign up for Sound Exchange.
Yes, and you can sign up your cover songs at Sound Exchange because it's about the master recording and the artist performing those songs. It is not about the owner of the songs. If you do an album full of cover songs, you do not own those songs, but you absolutely do own the rights to those master recordings. And so Sound Exchange pays for usage of those master recordings. So absolutely go sign up with Sound Exchange.
And the next one, this is a favorite topic. Your album art is terrible. With at CD Baby, with 500,000 artists, we do see our share of sharpied CDRs and you know, just atrocious album artwork.
I was at an artist meetup we just had in Nashville, and someone came up and handed me a CD that had nothing on it. Absolutely nothing. It was just a shiny disc. I asked if they could at least write their name on it, and they went and found a ballpoint pen and scribbled all over the CD.
Oh, my God.
That does not inspire someone to go listen to the music. And I know this can be a hot topic for artists where they say, I just want it to be all about the music. Why should this matter one bit? It absolutely matters. Because the way people look and search for music, they are going to see your album art before they can ever get to that play button, before they can ever put a CD in, before they can ever stream it. They are most likely going to see that artwork. Sure, there's some examples of like, hey, it's SoundCloud, I don't have any album art, whatever. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, in general, when you put out a product, they're going to see your album art first. And if it's terrible, it's not going to inspire confidence in pushing that play button.
I feel like a lot of artists don't assume that other people should judge their music the way that the artist has responded to other people's music. Like, when you think about your favorite album of all time, like, don't you in some way picture the album cover? Like, if it had a really shitty cover, would you be in love with that album as much as you are? Probably not. Like, it's this whole sensory experience.
Yeah, and that's the way it's always been. In fact, it's probably... you can almost make the case it's less so now, even though I wouldn't, because it used to be you'd go to a record store, and flip through records. You couldn't open them and hear them until like the early 2000s, where stores started having listening stations, or certain music stores would let you open the package to preview it. But yeah, you couldn't hear it, but you had to just go by what the album cover looked. So there are some things that you need to consider that, you know, if you are a country artist, you probably shouldn't look like, a death metal band on the cover. There's certain things, certain genre boundaries that, yes, you can bend those boundaries and there's exceptions to the rules. But if you're trying to speak to an audience and say, I'm a part of your tribe, my music fits with who you are, and this is a great indicator for the prospective listener to whether or not they're going to click on that play button. So that's the point with having good artwork.
Yeah. Well, and similar to your description of the merch shout out from stage, is that if you have a bad album cover, like, it's not going to inspire any confidence in what's actually on the disc or on the file. Like, you didn't put any effort into that. Why is your music going to be any good?
Yeah. Up next is... you didn't actually finish the distribution process.
More common than people might think.
That sounds like a ridiculous statement, but we see that happen over and over again. Artists get in a rush. They get to a point and they're like, oh, I don't have my files yet. I need to get them from the mastering guy. And they go ahead and upload the artwork. And so they stop the process and like, I'll come back tomorrow to do this. And then they forget, and maybe they remember uploading them to SoundCloud or Bandcamp and then think they did it. Then they come back to us like 2 months later wondering why it's not on Spotify and iTunes. I'm like, because you never finished. All you got to do is finish the process. And it happens more than you would think. So just make sure you've actually finished the process. Follow it through to the end. Make sure that it's on the stores that you're sending your fans to. And yeah, just learn how to finish things. Finish.
It's understandable. Like you said, like when you're putting out a release, there's a lot of things to juggle, and a lot of it is sort of a similar process. So I get it. But the next one on the list is you keep removing your back catalog. And this one kind of drives me nuts as a guy that I like who contributes to our blog occasionally. And he's got, you know, a pretty good fan base. And he wrote me a month or two ago and said, hey, I want to take such and such songs and albums off of Spotify. And I just wrote him back with one word: why? Like, what are you doing? Stop playing with your catalog and like keeping some of it from people in this regard and keeping some from this. It's like,
yeah. And this happens a lot. The thing that I see it happening, or the way it usually goes down, is an artist says, we've got this new album and it's the best we've ever done and we're embarrassed of our old music. And I get it. I'm an artist as well. I feel like pretty much every album new album I'm a part of is the best album that we've ever done. That's how we're wired as artists. So basically, you're saying all our fans who like those old albums should be embarrassed. And all that money coming from those old albums is no longer relevant. And it's just a ridiculous way to go about releasing music. If you want to make money in the distribution process, you need to be building a catalog. So if you keep removing your back catalog, that's not going to help you reach your goals. Leave that music out there. There's an infinite shelf life. Just let it be. Someone might discover it and love it and use it in some way that drives serious success for your music. Because I also hear the other one is, it's not selling, so I'm just going to remove it. And I'd be like, leave it.
Some of the people definitely not going to sell now.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to sell now if you take it down. And, you know, we've talked about on the podcast, I think in our playlisting discussion, that some of the stuff we've been seeing happen to artists on playlists that's been huge, amazing success have been tracks that have been in distribution for like since 2007. And they found their way on a playlist in 2017, 10 years later, getting millions of plays. And if you removed it, then it's that the opportunity is totally missed. You never know when success is going to happen or where it's going to come from. And it's not going to happen if you take your music away.
Well, and ideally, every new release is driving more attention to that back catalog rather than just having all of the focus on the new release.
Yeah, and the one thing that the other reason why people tend to say that is they use another distribution service that shall not be named that charges annual fees, and the bigger your catalog gets, the bigger that annual fee gets, and it can be a huge, huge bill. And that's where they go, I don't want to pay that bill. I'm just going to take this music down. I'm like, no, don't remove your music. Well, remove it from them, bring it to us. And then if your music sits there and does nothing, you owe us nothing. And it can stay there. And if you have some success, then we'll partner in it.
Amen.
Yes. All right. The next section, we're just going to talk about the music. Why you're not making money as it relates to your music. And we actually have some solid points here that I think are pretty good. So here we go.
The first one kind of touches on the last point we were making. Your catalog is too small. So when you put out a release, you don't have a history. You don't have other tunes or albums to kind of feed people to.
Been in the conversation a bunch where someone walks up to me and says, I'm not making any money. Why? And I ask them, well, how many albums do you have out? Or we have one song. We put it out 2 months ago. It's our first song. We're not making any money.
Yeah, you guys should just break up.
I'm like, it's not about writing one song. That's what I loved about Jack Conte's keynote at our conference last year. I've listened to that several times. It's a few episodes back on the podcast here. Worth listening to over and over again, because what he stresses is just that you've got to keep releasing music, and that predicting what's going to connect and what's not is darn near impossible. So the best thing you can do is just to create more and more and get better at creating, so you connect that those opportunities or those chances of connecting with people go up. You it's really hard to predict, and you may feel like you have the one perfect song, and it's like that song might be great. Just keep going. You got to keep releasing them, keep building a catalog. It's like building a mutual fund of all your little catalog assets that start over time, compound with interest to start building a solid revenue stream.
Yes, and one way to make sure that catalog is appealing to new listeners record some cover songs. So if you're not doing cover songs, you might be losing out.
Yep. Do cover songs, people. They're proven songs that have value. Do your interesting version of them. These songs have already proven themselves. People will buy them. Your interesting version of it will increase the chances of someone buying that track of yours.
Yep. And plus, we all know they're huge on YouTube.
That's right. Yes. If you want to be big on YouTube, do cover songs.
Oh, another thing that's big on YouTube is actually the next point. If you're not collaborating with other musicians, you're missing out. And that's particularly huge on YouTube, collaborations between channel owners.
Yeah, and I think the YouTube culture has shone a light on this more for just the music community at large. In fact, we were thinking about it for the upcoming Small Town Poets release that we're working on. There's a track that we did years ago that didn't really get released, and it was a duet between our lead singer and our band with a guest vocalist. And it never really got released, and so we were thinking about adding that to this album and finding the biggest name we could find that would do this with us, because we would be able to tap into their audience and collaborate. It'd be seen as a collaboration. They'd want to feature it to their audience. We'd feature them to our audience. And so everybody wins. And so that's the way you should be looking at this. You don't need to always think about, we just need to go do our albums and do our thing. Think about some fun one-off songs or small projects that can be collaborations with other folks. This could be huge for your music community if you do a series of CDs or albums where you collaborate with people in your your music scene. Especially if you're in smaller towns, it can be a great way to get the town to rally around the music community.
And if you add Christmas in there, that is an unbeatable formula.
That's right.
Christmas collaborations.
Take that to the bank every December.
What's the next? This kind of goes back to my jerk point that I made at the beginning of the episode. Your songs need to be better.
Yeah, if your songs are poor, if your songs are poor, then that's going to be a problem. And that's always subjective, so it's hard to know. But you need to have some good people in your life that can give you some constructive criticism and help you improve in that area. Everybody should be improving their craft. There's always improvement to be had. So it's not like you're going to release a point where you feel like, I'm the perfect songwriter. But, you know, you might be at a point where your songs still feel a little amateurish and you just need to do a little more woodshedding and focus on that to open up more opportunities for revenue.
Well, and there's ways to, you know, sort of affordably get that feedback if you can't, you know, you can't trust your family about things like that. And probably the members of your band think what you're doing is pretty good. But you can hire, you know, if you don't have the budget to hire a producer who's going to be with you in the studio the whole time, you could get a songwriter or a producer to give you kind of like a pre-production consultation. Pay them some money, have them send you, you know, a Word document of 3 pages of suggestions about your songs. Because, you know, the world is full of great performers and musicians. If the song is boring, like, that kind of kills it all for me. I don't care if you can sing great if you're singing something that's terrible.
Yep. Yep. And there's some bigger name artists where I feel like, man, they've got a cool sound. They've got the production's amazing. They're talented. And the songs are just kind of blah. And it's not like it's only for people that are starting out or still building a fan base. It can be a problem that can plague you pretty far in your career. And it might be that'll open up more revenue for you. And the next thing we have is the production quality is poor. You know, there again, this is subjective, and there are some things that it can add to the aesthetic, to the poor production, but it gets to a point where it can be unlistenable, or it just sounds cheap and amateurish. And like I said, it's subjective, but that could be something that's hindering you from making money from your music.
Yeah, and that's a tough one to deal with, because a lot of times it comes down to a lack of your own skills in that, you know, in engineering or production, or a lack of budget. And if you don't have either of those things, what can you do? I mean, yeah. I guess you dig into bettering your engineering skills, but it's a tough one to get around sometimes.
Yeah, well, and it's something that it's might not be as obvious or as glaring of an issue. Like before Small Town Poets was formed, the previous band that they had a song on an album that got distributed to radio stations. And it was there was a song that they were pitching that was catchy, but lots of radio stations said, we want to play it, but the quality is just not broadcast quality. It sounded like a great indie record, but it just wasn't broadcast quality. So it may not be that your fans won't buy it. It might be that it's limiting you from sync opportunities or, you know, radio opportunities. It can be some different areas where those, you know, those opportunities are hindering you. It might not just be that it sounds so bad no one wants to listen to it.
Yeah. So the next mistake that you're making, which explains why you're not making any money, is really interesting to me. Not releasing frequently. This is in the world of Spotify, super important, because as you build your following on a platform like Spotify, there's a good chance that those followers will get pinged every time you put out new music. So the more you're putting out, the more times they get notified of that, they get engaged with listening, maybe they add it to a playlist. You kind of have this chance to keep them active in terms of promoting your music.
Yeah, if you've listened to the podcast for a long time, you've heard my rant about U2 and them not releasing their latest album and it taking them like 5 years to release albums or put together an album and then not release it, or say they have multiple albums and they never come out. It's one of those things, those days are over. You've got to release music. I would say at minimum, get an album out a year. If that's too ambitious, get out tracks on a quarterly basis, something to keep people engaged. If you're trying to make revenue from your music and you want that to be your full-time career, it's the day and age where you got to keep music rolling. It needs to feel like they're a part of something that's ongoing and not something that shows up and leaves. And that's the reason why you want to release more frequently.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of a concept that we explored about 10 years ago when we were talking about the kind of cumulative EP release that eventually builds into an album. But that right now is a huge reality for some megastars. You know, like John Mayer, before he put out his new album, like was releasing 3 songs at a time on Spotify. It's like this really manageable chunk of music. You can probably produce 3 songs a lot quicker than you can 10. And then the more often you do it, the more often your fans are reminded that you're alive.
Exactly. All right. We need to pick up the pace because we still got a long way to go. And it's going to be a 5-hour podcast and I don't have that much time. But all right. Not making an event out of your release. And I know we've done a whole podcast about what you should do before your release and leading up to that. And I think this really speaks to the person that's just trying to, their album's done, they're trying to scrambling to get everything online that day and not taking a break, a pause, a deep breath and going, okay, I would love to get some major press. I need to start targeting a release date 3 months from now that I have the music done, or 2 months now for maybe a bigger local press, or a month from now for like the weekly entertainment paper. Those things take time, and not making an event out of the release, like a release show, it's usually a missed opportunity. Those are good hooks for press and for fans to rally around and get excited about it.
Yeah. So the last of the mistakes in the music section is poo-pooing streaming, which still happens all the time, and people keep their music off of these platforms that are the main way of accessing and enjoying and sharing music. Now, I don't understand it.
You got to get on board.
I do understand the revenue complaints in kind of general terms, but then when you think, well, Spotify's still not even profitable. Why do you hate this company that like...
Yeah, well, like you said, I understand the complaints in a general sense, but being on Spotify and engaging on Spotify does not mean that you have to send your fans only to Spotify. You may have 1,000 diehard fans that you say, you know what, go here, pay $25 for my CD, I'll sign it, and they'll all do it. And so that's what you need to do. But it's a matter of, if this is where the industry is going, if you're saying you're not going to participate, then don't complain when you don't make money, because that's where the industry is going. You have to participate. All right, next section.
Communication.
Section number 4 is communication and why you're not making money in regards to your communication. I think we can move through this one pretty quickly.
All right, number 1 in this section, you spam industry professionals. That is a crappy thing to do and a great way to make the person on the receiving end of that email feel like you don't give a damn or yeah. they don't give a damn about you.
And they will get tired of you really fast. And right on the heels of that, most of your spam is because you're only thinking of your needs and not that of the person on the other end. And so all you're thinking about is how you want to play that show and why you're so great and why you're amazing and why you should play that show. But you're not even thinking about the person on the other end who has a job to do, that needs to fill a venue, that needs to sell beer, that needs to sell food. And you need to address those needs. They've got needs in their calendar, but all you're talking about is how great you are. That's...
Well, and the flip side of thinking, not thinking about the needs of the recipient is that you overpromise and underdeliver. So like, you know, maybe you are thinking about the needs of a venue and you say, hey, we can get 400 people out on a Tuesday night and then there's 30 people in the audience. That talent buyer is not going to be thrilled.
And they're probably never going to have you back because they're going to assume everything you say from that point is an exaggeration. And so you never want to overpromise and underdeliver. We've done podcast episodes where we've interviewed club bookers, and they always cite that as do not do it. They'd rather you say, we can get 30 people out, and they'll go, okay, I'll put you on this bill where I think with your 30 people, we'll have a good show. And the other band's 100 people. That'll make a good show. They'd rather know the truth so they can work with that than feel like you lied to them.
All right, next on the list, bad grammar. And I would add to that, all caps locks. Like, don't make your emails hard to read, whether it's syntactically, like you're not writing in complete sentences, or I have to suddenly look at this block text paragraph. Oh, it's awful. And yeah. Basically, there's no quicker way for me to delete an email unless if I see that, it's done. Like, I don't have the energy for that.
Yep. Don't do it. It'll get deleted. And on the heels of that, even worse than bad grammar, all caps is... don't treat email like it's a text. I get emails like that all the time where it's like mid-thought. I have no idea what they're saying. They're referencing a conversation we had where in person like 2 months ago. I don't know what they're talking about. They don't even really tell me what they're wanting. I just delete it. It's a waste of my time, and I'm not going to want to deal with them again.
Yeah, you know, I would add a pet peeve of mine is that when you ask someone, let's say, 3 questions by email, and they respond and they answer one of them. Like, did you read? It's so easy. Just go in sequence.
Yes. Huh. Yes. And that sort of leads into a couple of the other ones. One, writing a book in your emails. This is not a chance to tell your life story. People are busy. When I open an email from someone and it feels like I should be sitting by a fireplace enjoying a beverage to read this, I'm going to move on. I don't have that much time at work or that much focus to really dive in and just make it simple. Don't write giant paragraphs. Just get to the point.
You mean you don't actually sit by the fire with a beverage and read your work emails?
I won't deny that's probably happened before, but you know, not while I'm in the office. You have to be someone very intriguing for me to do that after hours. Another one is you don't follow instructions. If the club booker says, please send me a band photo this size and an MP3 in email, attach this email and a bio, and then you send them links to your website in return saying, go download this. They're going to say, no, that's not how I work. I need you to do it this way. Or you just don't follow instructions. So many people burn bridges by just not following instructions.
Or you don't follow up at appropriate times.
Yes. And there are appropriate times to follow up. There are inappropriate times to follow up. You don't follow up 5 minutes after you sent the first email.
You don't follow up every single day.
No. No. You do want to follow up, and sometimes it feels like you might be pushing it a little bit, but you know, sometimes people are busy, and them not responding isn't because they're not interested. It's they're busy, and they have to prioritize their work, and your request just isn't top priority. But if you keep following up at appropriate times, a lot of times they'll get back to you. And then just with the communication in general, the last one I had here was not targeting the right fans. You don't email all your fans in your country when you're playing a show in one city. That just drives people crazy. They don't need to know about every single show. Target the right people. don't spam your list, that you'll just lose people off your list if you're emailing everyone about a particular show in a particular city.
Yeah, there's one thing on this list one thing missing on this list that I thought of, which is that you can make assumptions about your communication which are incorrect. So, for instance, if you were to write someone once a month and you never hear back from them, that doesn't mean that they don't like you. It doesn't mean that they don't want to hear from you. They just might not have an immediate need to respond to you, or you don't meet one of their immediate needs. But you can keep writing them and following up, and you know, maybe one day they'll write back and say, "This is awesome, great, thanks," and then there's a connection made. On the flip side, if they say no, thank you, or you know, I'm not interested, then stop writing. You know, you've got your answer.
Yeah,
but I feel like it's good to not make assumptions until you actually have, you know, have the answer.
All right, so that section was communication. We've got the last section, section number 5, and it's hustle. And I'm just gonna power through these so we can get to calls. So hustle. What I mean is, you know, well, let's just get to the list. So here's some ways that you might not be making money as it relates to hustle. Not networking, not getting to know people in the scene in your area, the music business in your area, the artists in your community. So you're not networking. Complaining. People sitting around complaining and like, I don't want, everything is just too hard. I mean, you're probably not going to see success when you're sitting around complaining all the time. You got to make things happen.
Especially when you're complaining about networking. I shouldn't have to meet people. It should all be all about the music.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, well, it's not.
You're unfocused. You're not shooting for specific goals. You're just all over the map, and so you're doing a lot of wasted work and task switching and going after this thing half-heartedly, then that thing, and you're just all over the place, getting some focus. And you mentioned networking. Yes, the music business is very much a relationship business. It's still as much as ever. Getting out and meeting people is a good way to advance your career. People want to help people
well,
they
and
know.
And I think, I know we're trying to rush through these points, but I feel like it's worth mentioning that networking sounds fake. It sounds, I don't know, like, I don't think it has to be that way. Like, we went to a music biz networking thing last week, and I felt like I met a lot of really cool people that I could be friends with if we just met at a bar. And I mean, ideally, the people you are, quote, networking with are in the music business or music fans or other musicians. Like, those should be your friends anyways.
Yeah, and you should go with the idea of how do I learn from these people? And I think it changes it. Instead of going feeling like, I just want to know these people so I can get something from them, that just makes it seem fake. And no one's going to think you're trying to build authentic relationships. All right, I said no goals. And I want to say, as far as hustle goes, not paying attention to the real opportunities. Sometimes there's some real opportunities that feel more like baby steps, and you're just shooting for the stars. And so a lot of times you just disregard some of those things that are really what will help you out and start paying the bills. But you want to be famous, and so everything else just has to take a backseat to that.
Yeah, okay, so the one thing I can't remember if you mentioned or not, but a unified vision. So when you're setting your goals, it shouldn't just be for yourself. If you're working with a team or a band or whatever, like, everyone's got to be on the same page about that goal, so you're all working in concert.
Yeah, it can feel like, you know, we're a band, we're making great music, and you can make some really bad assumptions that everyone's on the same page, and one person's like, I want to go on the road and spend 6 months out of the year touring, and someone else is like, no way, I hate that. Our music's great, I love riding with you guys, I want to play one show every month, max. And so you got to have a unified vision, otherwise it's going to cost you money. And then that leads to the last thing we have on the list: someone in the band doesn't really want it. And this happens a lot with bands, like one or two people are like the main driving force behind it, and somebody else is just kind of there. And, you know, they'll show up and do whatever, but they're just really not on board as far as going after it and hustling and doing the things that need to be done in order to make money.
They want it as long as it's fun and easy.
Yeah, it's kind of a hobby, a distraction for them. Even though they may be very talented, it has nothing to do about talent. That was the shocker to me when I went to Nashville in college. Some of the most talented people I've ever seen in my life, still to this day, aren't doing anything in music just because they didn't really want it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, where I felt like I was scratching and clawing for anything I got because to make up for the lack of talent and because I wanted it. I wanted it. I still want it, Chris. I still want it.
Well, you've made it. You were Grammy nominated.
I was. Still am.
That's a kind of making it.
As our manager still said when it life. Happened, they can never take that away from us.
All right. I will say for listeners, we do have a sixth category, but I think we're going to leave it as a mystery.
I think you started out with that.
I don't know if you remember.
Oh no, we didn't. We didn't. No, it's a mystery.
It's even harsher than what I started with, but we shouldn't mention it.
If someone wants to email us, they can get that secret sixth category. Let's see how many people actually made it to this point in the podcast and actually care enough to email us. All right, we've got some phone calls, and I've got 11 minutes, and I think we can get these calls in. The first one is a little bit longer, but it pertains to Facebook Live, and it was just a comment someone called in about how another band was doing some interesting things with Facebook Live. And so this was in response to our last episode, and here it is.
Hey, Kevin and Chris, this is Nick from Ohio. I've been listening to your podcast for a while now, and I just heard the Facebook one, the latest one, about the videos on Facebook. I just wanted to quickly share an example of how a local musician over here did pretty well using Facebook. His name's Dominic Francesco on Facebook. And his manager, his mom, they say momager, she had the great idea of doing a Facebook Live video for him. And what they did was, this was back when Facebook wasn't forcing sound to be played at all times. They kind of made him write out a few phrases on a piece of paper saying, like, hey, what's up? It's me, Dominic. Check out my band. So he started in one room doing the flashcards, got up and, like, motioned everybody to move to the next room where the band was already kind of jamming on one of the riffs to the song. And then his mom was holding the camera. She moved around the room, showed the drummer first and the guitarist, and then by the time it went back to him, he was singing and on the piano, and it was really exciting. And he ended up getting like 1.5 million views on that one video. So moving forward, they decided to keep using Facebook Live, get their fans up, and the newest thing they started doing was they'll do Q&A with fans live, so they'll get a local musician or photographer to come read them questions off and do Q&A live videos, like tell their fans when it's going to be Thursday at 8 p.m. or whatever, and it actually seems really popular. Last time I tuned in, it was questions flying. So anyway, that's all I wanted to give you guys that quick example. And again, it's Nick from Ohio. My bands are High Wire Kicks and Coy Hill. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks for that call, Nick. I thought that was interesting, the idea that they started the Facebook Live thing with, you know, someone holding flashcards and doing something active where when you scroll down, the audio's not on, and basically it'd be interesting to like engage people that way. Like it's starting, turn your audio on, and then doing something where it's like, oh, they're going into this other room and playing music. So thanks for the call. Interesting to hear how other people are using Facebook Live. We'd love to hear more about Facebook Live. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add one comment about that, which also in the interview you did with Wade, an important feature of both those broadcasts was that there was someone else doing the camera work. You know, it wasn't just you setting up a camera and playing in front of it, which I think can also be really cool. But, you know, the fact that the mom was moving the camera around, it's a little more dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we've got another, we've got two more calls. These are much quicker, and but they're good. So let's get to them.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Rob. My name is Melanie Grace. I listen to your podcast every time it comes out, and I love it. After listening to the most recent podcast you did with the entertainment lawyer, the music lawyer, I was thinking about my album recording, and I wanted to record my own Christmas album, and I'm actually a member of a gospel choir. So I was thinking about having my gospel choir perform background vocals, but because I don't want them to own part of the song, I understand I probably have to do a work-for-hire form. But do I need to do a work-for-hire form for every single individual in that choir that's going to sing? Or would it just be one form for, like, the choir director in charge of them? Let me know. You can find me anywhere on social media, at the Melanie Grace. And I only have one song on.
Oh, it cut off. I think that was as far as she got on the answering machine. So it accidentally cut off. But you want to take this one, Rob? I could see honest mistake. Honest
mistake. You know, that's actually the most common mistake with me. So I don't know. Do you know the answer to it off the top of your head?
First of all, I should say we're not lawyers, but my guess would be that unless all those singers have some sort of contract as being a part of that choir, therefore being able to sign corporately as the choir one release, you would probably need a release form from everyone.
That sounds right to me.
I would do that and just know that you're covered because, yeah, it's going to be easier that way. But we're not lawyers. We do have a lawyer now at CD Baby, one of our longtime employees who's worked here since the beginning that we've worked here. He became a lawyer recently, and now he's kind of an in-house lawyer. So we should have the lawyer moment with Joel. That should become a part of
that. That would be actually a great segment. Yeah. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm also not Rob.
All right, Chris, we got one more call.
Hey, how's it going? My name is Sean Johnson. I go by DJ Sean J. I just finished listening to episode 186, and I was actually listening all the way through. I've been a longtime listener, but I was listening specifically hoping to get some answers about sampling, sample clearance, sample usage in recorded records for the producer perspective. I love what you guys are doing, but I do have a thought that there's a lot of producers as well as, I guess, singer-songwriters who use sampled music in their work. And I'm trying to find out wherever I can things about the industry, but I'd appreciate some overview on the usage of sampled music, what is legally allowed, what is not legally allowed, how to go about clearing samples, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that would be looking for some guidance on that information. See you guys at the conference. Thanks a lot.
All right. We will see you at the conference.
Yeah, so the first thing I was going to say is if the sample is recognizable, nothing is legally allowed in and of itself unless it's cleared. There's urban myth out there that if it's less than a certain amount of seconds, you know, less than 3 seconds, less than 6 seconds, then you can use it. That is not true. So if you really wanted to use a sample, you would have to both clear it with the publisher and the label that owns the recording. Or you could recreate that sound on your own, basically do a new recording of that little riff or beat or whatever, in which case I believe you only need to clear it with the publisher.
Well, yeah, and it could go both ways, because if it's something that isn't recognizable as the song but is recognizable from that recording, you may only need the master rights usage. But it gets messy. It gets real messy. Excuse me, it's choking me up. It gets so messy. It's a big problem for hip-hop music. In fact, I will amend my list for our section on why you're not making money, going back to the music. If you're using lots of samples, we see this happen all the time, even with big hip hop releases that, you know, we're not distributing but are on labels. You hear stories about all the time. They didn't clear the sample. They get in trouble. The music gets removed. It's especially a huge issue when talking about not making money from your music on YouTube. I would say that wager that 8 out of every 10 copyright claims on YouTube when it comes to artists doing original music is because they've used a sample that they did not have the rights to. The best thing to do, the best practice, is to just create your own beats and not sample stuff. If you're gonna sample and you wanna release it legally and you wanna make the most money from it that you possibly can, you have to go get the rights from the copyright owners. And depending on what it was that you sampled, that could involve the publisher and the master rights holder.
Yeah, and requesting that permission is not a cut and dry process either. You have to get a hold of them. You have to get their attention enough that they want to even respond to you. Then, before they're going to say yes to anything, most likely they want to hear what you've done with their work. They're going to listen to it. Then they can say yes or no. If they say yes, you can use it. They set the terms, and then suddenly that could be they want to own half of your publishing for the song, or maybe they just want an upfront fee for $50,000. You know, it could be any number of things. As you said, particularly depending on how it's used, the more prominent it is, the more they'll want. So yeah, it gets complicated.
All right. Well, thank you for all those calls. And you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209. Or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or weigh in the comment section at our website for this episode. It's just cdbabypodcast.com. And hey, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. We're doing a whole lot more of them lately. You don't want to miss an episode. Subscribe in your podcatcher app or the iTunes podcast section, and feel free to leave a nice comment. If you don't have anything nice to say, we encourage you not to leave a comment. But if you have nice things to say, leave some a review or a comment of the podcast. We'd appreciate it. And I think that's going to be it. I'm really interested to see if people have some ideas of things that we missed from our list of why you're not making money, because I felt it was very exhaustive. I'm exhausted.
I'm sure there's 20 more things that we didn't think of.
All right. And we hope to see you in Nashville in August, August 25th through 27th. Head to DIYMusicianCon.com. That's DIYMusicianCon.com. And get your tickets. Book your hotel room. You will have the time of your life. You can see Chris dancing out to Don't Stop Believin'.
And requesting Katy Perry songs and being rejected.
No, we'll find someone for you, Chris. We'll find the match. We need to right this wrong. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll catch you later.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.